Well, good morning, everyone. We're going to get started right on time so that I can quit right on time to get you to lunch. Because those meals, that's important, family camp. You don't want to be 1 second late. You know, my husband and I go around to a lot of family camps all summer long, and Mount Hermon has really good food. I'm just telling you. You know, it's up there. There's probably only one that I would even dare to say is equal, and the rest are quite below. So appreciate all the good food you're having this week and somebody else preparing it and cleaning it all up. It's a huge blessing. Let's start with a word of prayer. Lord, we do thank you for this just amazing opportunity, blessing, gift for these families to be able to come to a place like Mount Hermon. How many Christian families in the world would love to have a week like this where you can just pour into them, they could be together with their families and have just all the luxuries that are here. And so I just pray that each one here would be incredibly grateful and would also use this week to its fullest capacity for all the things you have planned, for them to grow close as a family, for you to pour into their lives truths that will sustain them through the year, and just build a closer relationship with you. And as we consider this difficult topic this morning, I pray that you would also just give us incredible wisdom as we navigate our changing culture and the influence that that is having on our children. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. Changing culture. Things are getting different rapidly. Parenting your kids through tough questions about faith, we're going to start with the bad news, get that out of the way, and that is the fact that kids are leaving the faith. I give you in your notes, make sure you pick those up, a URL for Cold Case Christianity. You can go home and click on that, and what I love about this is that they took all kinds of books and research that have been done, and they compile it for you so that in a pretty short really quickly, you can get a lot of research about the fact of our kids leaving. So they have got research related to the spiritual life of teenagers, research related to the attitude of college professors, which is very interesting when they actually figure out who the majority of college professors are in public universities. They are not real friendly to Christian faith and life. And then other kinds of research as well. So what I want to do is just hit some of this reality that I think will give you the picture, and then you can look more deeply when you get home if you pull up that URL. But first of all, just in general, what's going on in our culture regarding the Christian faith, Pew Research does a tremendous amount of research in the area of religion and faith life. They're probably the biggest organization doing this kind of work. They do massive surveys, so not just tiny little 2,000 person, but big surveys that take a long time. So their research is showing, and this is all confirmed by other groups that are doing research like Gallup and Barna, that adults who describe themselves as Christian, that number is declining. So in 2007, it was at 78.4%. down in 2015 to 70.6%. Now, what this means is that when people are doing a survey and there's a list of religions that they say they would affiliate with, they check the box that says Christian. That's just how they self-identify. Doesn't mean they go to church. It doesn't mean they believe Jesus died on the cross for their sins. It doesn't mean any of that, but that's just how they self-identify, is down in our country to 70.6. Adults who describe themselves as none, so they go down the list, and these are adults 18 and up, and they check, well, I don't consider myself affiliated with any of those categories. They check a box called none, and we call them the nuns, not N-U-N-S, of course, but N-O-N-E-S, and that number is rising very rapidly from 16% in 07 to 22.8% in 2015. Other surveys have confirmed this sort of thing, but what they're finding is that the number of people who are identifying as none is the highest in the younger age groups. So in this survey that was done in 2016, 39% of young adults aged 18 to 29. So when they zero in on those 18 to 29 year olds, 39% are religiously unaffiliated versus 13% of seniors who are 65 and older. So you see that it does come out to that 22%, but it's heavily weighted in the category of the 18 to 29-year-olds that are considering themselves religiously unaffiliated. And the other thing that's very interesting in all the research is that they're finding that adults who leave their childhood religion are doing so before reaching adulthood. In other words, it used to be that this kind of a decision wouldn't be made until maybe well into their 20s. They might decide to leave a faith that they were raised with. But this decision is being made much younger, even down into the junior high years, and definitely in the high school years. 79% of those unaffiliated young adults report making this decision during their adolescent and teen years. So think of a 13-year-old junior higher. They are already making decisions about what role faith is going to play in their life once they get out on their own. So those kind of decisions, and this has been borne out just anecdotally. We have a Christian school at our church up through eighth grade, and one of our pastors teaches the Bible class, and he said absolutely, he already has students who are deciding that they don't believe in absolute truth. They're 13 years old. They don't believe there is absolute truth. They don't know that they believe Christianity is true, already making those kinds of decisions at that age. A book called Souls in Transition, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of Emerging Adults, 2009. And now emerging adults would be those who are kind of finishing up college. They're moving out into their adult lives. 15% would say embrace a strong faith. So that's pretty small percentage. 30% tend to customize their faith. So those that do have faith say, well, I don't really agree with everything I was raised with. I'm changing it. And that really fits our American culture. We are a culture that loves salad bars and buffets, right? And so we do that with things like spirituality. We go down the list of options and we take what we like and we leave behind what we don't like. And we kind of make our own mix and we personalize. So that's very common in the young adult age group. 15% believe in a higher power. So they've already moved to something very vague, spirituality of some vague nature. 5% say that they have no exposure at all as an emerging adult to any religious people, any religious ideas, or any religious organizations. Now you might think, how can that possibly be? But I tell you, we live here in Santa Cruz that has a minuscule church attendance percentage, very, very tiny number of people go to church. It's a really fully secular culture in Santa Cruz. And we meet people all the time who say, I've never known a Christian, I've never been in a church ever in my whole life. And so this is not a surprising, and I think that number is only going to go up. 10%, there are a few seats in here. I'm sorry that we're kind of a little crowded. There's a few up front, if you don't mind my spitting on you. You can sit up front. 10% are fully skeptical of religious faith. So these would be the people that have really embraced sort of the what they call the new atheism that's very antagonistic to faith, not just like, well, I have my way, you have yours, but they're trying to actually deconvert people. So you've got 10% that are very, very skeptical of religious faith and think the world would be a better place without it. Just confirming that, again, some of these studies are now getting a little old, and I think we'd be a little surprised at how these numbers have gotten even worse. In 2006, 66% of 20-somethings had been churched at one point during their teen years, but they are now spiritually disengaged. An Assemblies of God study, now this was just in their own congregations, but they found that between 50 and 66% of their young people who attend a non-Christian public or private university will have left the faith 4 years after entering college. Lifeway research, 70% of young people will leave the faith in college. This was in 2007. Now, they found that about 35% of those 70% return. But I don't know. That was done in 2007. I don't know if that would even be holding up today. We just don't know with this younger generation, the 18 to 29-year-olds that are considered the millennials, are they going to come back? We know a huge percentage have left. The question is, we don't know yet if they are going to keep true to that 35% that return perhaps when they start a family and have kids, and sometimes that can be a catalyst for them thinking about faith again, but we just don't know. The Fuller Youth Institute in 2010, they're doing wonderful work in this area. I'm going to be talking about them a little bit more. But they found, now they studied what they called youth group graduates. So these are kids that were fully engaged in their church youth group through their senior year of high school. So they were even youth leaders. They were in, very, very engaged in their faith and in their youth group. That 40 to 50% of those still struggle with their faith after graduation. So these are, to me, when I started seeing all this, I'm like, these are alarming statistics. We cannot just sit there and go, well, I hope my kid isn't one of those. You know, what are we going to do as parents? What are the reasons that our kids are leaving the faith? I think you cannot underestimate the influence of our secular culture. The emphasis in a secular culture, let me define secular, because I'm not talking about just separation of church and state, which is actually a good thing. I believe in that. I think it allows for actually the most freedom is when you have that separation of church and state. So I'm not talking about that, but I'm talking about a secular mindset that the emphasis is on the here and now. You know, there's no concept of anything eternal or transcendent at all. So because we have a human need, it's universal, we have a human need for meaning in our life and a sense of purpose and satisfaction and freedom and even identity and hope. These things are universal to our human nature. Well, secularism has done a really good job of presenting a narrative that tells our young people how they can have all of that without any reference to God or to any kind of faith or religion. I don't think it actually holds up, but they do present a narrative that, oh, you can have all the meaning in your life, you can have satisfaction, you can have identity and freedom and all these things. And these secular messages are not just coming in a university classroom, they certainly come there, but they are surrounding our children from a very, very young age in ways we don't even realize. Because looking around the room, most of you are, you know, older, you're 30s, 40s, 50s, me, I'm in my late 50s. We can't imagine the kind of input our kids are receiving that we never had when we were growing up. Just, I mean, yeah, we had TV. I had to wait till 4 o'clock in the afternoon for anything good to come on, Gilligan's Island or whatever it was, you know. And there were commercials on TV, but that just is dwarfed by what our kids are getting all the time, because you not just have ads. And the recent research on how many ads we see every day, it's like, do I really see, you know, over 1,000 ads every day? Apparently we do, because they're just coming at us. We don't even realize that we're getting these ads all the time. Movies, of course, are hugely influential. Songs and just our pop culture in general, you know, stuff that magazines write about. Social media, boy, I mean, that has just been a game changer for our kids. Our kids have grown up with screens. You know, we didn't get our first computer in our family till I was, you know, I mean, in my mid-30s was the first time we actually had one in our home. Our kids are like, well, what did you do? You know, I mean, how did you live? You know, when I tell them that, yeah, I went through grad school, my last paper in grad school was typed on a typewriter. And somebody said, oh, look at this. It's called a word processor. And I just went, man, that would have really helped. But no, I mean, so everything has been changed that so dramatically with now with social media, sports, the news, cultural trends, just the internet. And it's just the sheer volume of information and disinformation that's available on the internet really overwhelms us. And in fact, that 18 to 29 generation, they say, has what's known as kind of decision fatigue about even deciding what to believe, because they're bombarded constantly with these kind of social messages. For example, let me just harp on the secular idea of individual freedom. Now, I believe in freedom. I think it's a really important value. But freedom has been taken to such an extent that the complete freedom of any choice is the very best good that you can have. Even the freedom to you know, have my own moral values or to choose my own identity. I'm not even going to let my body tell me what gender I am. I'm going to choose that. And I'm not going to go with just two categories. You know, I'm going to feel free to identify however I want. That individual freedom to define oneself is huge. And it becomes the only sin that's not tolerated is intolerance of somebody else's choices, right? That everyone should have complete freedom in terms of moral values and how they identify and all of that sort of thing. And that, so then religion becomes, you know, an enemy of personal freedom. So just for instance, I was watching the Warriors back in June win. And there was a commercial that kept coming on during the breaks that was for Subway. And I realized, as I had seen it a few times, I'm like, I was listening to the song that Subway chose. Now, this was just a song. They didn't write the song for Subway, but you know how they'll go, hey, that would be a great song for our ad. So I'm going to play it for you. I want you to listen to the lyrics of the song and also look at the imagery that's being presented there. Okay. Well, I mean, that's fine for choosing a sandwich at Subway, right? You know, turkey, pastrami, make it what you want. So it's a good commercial for that. But the words and also just the imagery is sending a message there that making it what you want, your whole life what you want, is when you're going to really have fun and you're really going to live, right? So look, just look at these lyrics. You can do and you can say anything you want. Live your life, I'll live mine any way I want. You can have and you can take anything you want. And here's the only caveat, make it what you want. That's the only condition, is to just make sure anything you want is fine as long as you want it. And you may go, well, you know, that's just a commercial, but our kids are bombarded with this kind of a message. In fact, Elsa in Frozen, how many of you have little girls who watch, could sing every lyric to Frozen, right? Have you ever listened to the lyrics? Elsa sings, "It's time to see what I can do to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. Definition of that, I'm free." So our culture is defining freedom as having no rules, and no one can tell me what's right or wrong. And our kids, they're absorbing this, and that's a huge challenge for us, because, you know, Jesus, the whole Christian message is a huge paradox, that Jesus said, actually, if you try to find your life that way, you're going to lose it. And it's only by actually living in the blessed restriction of giving your life to me that you find it, and that you actually have freedom. It defines freedom in a totally different way. But our kids are picking up these messages all the time. So, and you could probably give me 100 other examples of that. So the influence of our secular culture, and then also just intellectual doubt. Again, these have been multiplied by access to the internet. But some of these have been around for millennia. Christians and people of faith have been asking these kind of questions. The problem of suffering and evil is one. It goes back to the book of Job, right? Why did this bad thing, really bad thing, happen to me? So the problem of suffering and evil and just the existence of God is a huge question for our young people. How do we actually know that there is a God? The whole question of hell has become really big in the last, say, 20 years. How can this good, loving God that you tell me about in Sunday school send my best friend to hell just because she doesn't also believe in Jesus? It doesn't make any sense, that doctrine. And so the doctrine of hell is huge. The Bible, can we trust it? You can go online and just find all kinds of stuff about, oh, the Bible's full of errors, and it hates women, and it's against the environment, and, you know, whatever you can find, you know, can we trust this Bible, this ancient document? How can Christianity be the only true religion? Again, if you're living in California, or many other communities as well, your kids are probably going to school with kids of other faiths. And they're like, the Muslim kid's a nice kid. The Hindu kid, she's really nice. She's nicer than some of my Christian friends. And, you know, so there's that whole question about, well, then how can Christianity in this world of all these religions, how can it be the only true religion? And then there's the whole question of science. You know, hasn't science kind of ruled out God? Do we really even need the wasn't God just a way for us to explain things that we couldn't understand in our world? And now that we understand so much more about how it all works, we don't really need God anymore. Now we've kind of figured it all out, and it's all natural. So all of these questions are huge. So I have three kids, a boy who's 20, a girl who's 26, and a boy who's 28. Man, he's a man. They're all doing great in terms of their walk of faith. My youngest is still in his, what I call that transitional phase. Because every kid is going to go through that transitional phase where it has to move from the faith that I was taught in my family to this is, I own this. I believe this. I want to live it. My trust is actually in Christ. And if they don't go through that phase, you know, then they end up having some superficial, yeah, I'll check the Christian box, mom, kind of thing. But it doesn't become their own. So it's really critical that they go through it. But it's very painful as parents when they are going through it. Because you just want to keep them back, their little kid innocent faith that they had, but it has to grow up. So I would say my youngest is still in that process of growing up and struggling with aspects of his faith. And he has some friends, kids that were in and out of our house that I know, who have left the faith. In fact, one of his friends last year at 21, he announced on Facebook that he was no longer, not only was he no longer Christian, he no longer believed in God at all. And he started his own blog site, and he started it off with a blog, Questions to Challenge the Christian Worldview. And I just have a picture of it there, but just so you see how many challenges he feels like there are to the Christian worldview. I mean, it's page after page after page that he says, this doesn't make sense to me anymore. And a lot of this stuff I recognize right off the internet and from people like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and those people that are out there actively working against faith. I recognized a lot of these arguments. And I actually, I responded on the blog. I said, wow, you know, these are great questions. But have you looked at what any great Christian thinkers have actually, how they've responded? These questions have actually been around for a long time, many of them, and there have been great Christian thinkers, ancient to modern, who have dealt with these questions. And he said, well, I felt like I got all I needed growing up. And, you know, and he didn't, of course, but, you know, he's just like, I'm exploring this, and this seems to make more sense to me. He said, but I guess I should be open, you know, if you want to recommend a book to me, but I have a lot of other stuff I'm reading right now. So, you know, it was kind of like, yeah, you're right, I probably should, but I don't want to, because this, you know, there's a deconversion story that goes with this sometimes, that like, wow, I feel so free, I've been released. And, you know, that can be a very powerful story that you're telling yourself. And so then, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with this young guy. So this, you know, these intellectual questions are important. And my concern is, just not not going too personal on this one kid, but you know, it was a very tight, homeschooled, they didn't want a lot of outside influence kind of family. Well, outside influence is going to come at some point, unless you keep your kids locked in their bedroom till they're 50. The outside influence is going to come, and the key is, are they prepared for that? Are you prepared to be prepared for that? So that's really the question. So these intellectual doubts. Then there's also a negative experience or observation regarding the church or the faith. So you do hear stories of toxic kind of church environments, and kids, when they're done with it, they're like, I'm done with the whole thing. I don't need that in my life. You know, it was a place of strife and or maybe no grace and mercy. You talk about grace and mercy, but, you know, my friend Linda got pregnant and she was kicked out of the youth group, you know, and they don't perceive Christianity as actually walking the walk that it talks. You know, they maybe see hypocrisy. We have to be very humble and acknowledging of the fact that if you're in a church family, it's a messy thing. And if we somehow try to say, oh, no, this is all perfect, kids can just see right through that. So they have these negative experiences, or they get confused about what the message of Christianity actually is, and they think it's some kind of political message or something like that. You know, so, you know, these negative experiences, even if they're not real, they're perceived to be very negative. And so these are another reason, sorry I didn't put that up, that people are leaving, or young people. Also a lack of an articulate faith. So Christian Smith and Melinda Denton wrote a book called Soul Searching, The Religious and Spiritual Lives of American Teenagers. And they found something, again, very surprising. These are looking at churched teenagers that go to church with their families. I don't know exactly, you know, what the percentage of time they go, but they are considered to be churched kids. And they found that the majority of teenagers that they interviewed are incredibly inarticulate about their faith, about their religious beliefs and practices, and about its place in their lives. So when they were asked all these questions, they were just unable to really articulate a real Christian faith. In fact, they said the de facto dominant religion among contemporary U.S. teenagers is what they call moralistic therapeutic deism. Maybe you've heard this term before, moralistic therapeutic deism. And this basically says, you know, a God exists, you know, who created and orders the world and watches over human life on earth. God wants people to be good and nice and fair to each other, as taught in the Bible and by most world religions. And the central goal of life, listen to this, is to be happy and to feel good about oneself. So that's where the therapeutic, you know, you're good, you should feel good about yourself. God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life except when God is needed to resolve a problem. So there's really no purpose to pray unless you need something. And then good people go to heaven when they die. You know, this is kind of, now I'm sure they interviewed teenagers who were much more articulate than this about their faith, but they said they were surprised that this became like the dominant actual religion of our teenagers. This is not going to hold up with the secular world that our kids are going out into. This is not going to be sustainable as a faith. So they probably will leave that behind. So that lack of an articulate faith. And then also just faith becoming irrelevant. They don't see the relevance of faith. Now, why don't they see the relevance? Well, there could be a whole slew of possibilities. Maybe, you know, again, and I'm not to like, it's all your fault kind of thing, but what are they seeing in our families? Are they seeing that we live just like every other family on the street, and then, but we also go to church on Sunday? Are they understanding how faith is changing your life, the way you actually live your life? You know, I just don't know. So, but also, life as a teenager, when you just think back on your own 18, 19-year-old self, when you go off to college or go off to starting new adventures, there's a lot of things to distract, right? So you've got, you know, college and friends and romance and just the freedom of getting in a car and driving where you want to go, and that your mom isn't there to tell you, you know, when to be back or whatever. So you've got all this newfound freedom. And, you know, some students have said, well, I just need a break from the whole church thing. They just kind of put their faith and all of that on the shelf because there's all of this new stuff that's so exciting. So they just don't see the relevance of what that has to do with all this new stuff that they're finding exciting. Or they say, you know, well, I'm just realizing it doesn't work for me. They could just be being rebellious against their upbringing. You know, the human person is a complex thing. And sometimes there's cognitive dissonance, and that is when psychologists call this when you have two truth claims that you believe, two things you believe to be true that are not compatible with one another. Eventually, one of them is going to have to give. You can't live with that kind of tension forever. And so if you believe that the Bible is true and that Jesus is the Son of God and he's wise in how he tells us to live and so forth, but I also want to fill in the blank. I want to sleep with my boyfriend and girlfriend, or I want to enjoy the party life, or whatever it is, however long, you know, that tension's not going to last forever. Eventually something's going to give, and a lot of time it's like, well, what does the Bible know about life, you know? Or, you know, that was written 3,000 years ago. You know, everything has changed. I don't need to abide by those sexual guidelines or whatever. So faith becomes irrelevant because of what they want to do that the Bible says is not a good thing to do. So these are just some of the reasons. If I polled you, maybe I will. Is there something I've missed from this list? Yeah. Right. Right.
And so all four of our kids, I know, prayed a prayer when they were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old.
Right.
But I wonder if the real issue is that God has a calling yet. We think kids, because they go to church, they're Christians, just like we do because somebody sits in the pew next to us.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And never had that discussion with them about the Lord Christ.
Mm-hmm. They were never really in. Sure. I think that's absolutely part of it. And that goes back to that lack of an articulate faith, that they don't even really know what it's about. You know,
they have not come to faith.
They have not actually come to faith. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yes. Yeah. It is. It's part of that making it their own journey. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not going to stand here and say I completely understand how that all works, because I saw what appeared to be very genuine faith in my children. And, you know, that gives me a lot of hope if they were to kind of walk away from it. But then also the Bible talks about that perseverance and, whole, you know, faith to the end kind of thing. So I don't know how that all works. But I think it would be good if we don't just go, well, as long as they prayed a prayer when they were 4, everything's fine. You know, we want to make sure, again, that they actually have come to faith. Yeah.
I was wondering if there's an age where you might expect for, like, a child who's more concrete thinker, like, well, I can't see God, so I don't think there is a God.
Right. Yeah. They say that children really start thinking more conceptually like that, more around, you know, puberty. But some kids definitely have that much earlier. My daughter absolutely was a 7-year-old questioning me. We were walking to her girlfriend's house to play, and she said, Mom, out of the blue, Mom, so if Jesus is the Son of God and Jesus is God, he must be the Son of himself. And I'm like, who are you at 7 that you're delving? You know, obviously she had been thinking about the Trinity, and now I've got a block to try to work that out with her, you know. And I'm like, what have you done to me, Lord? Don't give me a child like that. But yeah, so some kids much earlier on are thinking, you know, those kind of things. And maybe you've got kids like that. And so we have to be ready, even at that age. How are we going to, and yet you've got to be simple enough. You know, you can't kind of download too much. So you've got to be able to be ready with some very simple things. And I think there are some great simple things just for the whole question of the existence of God that even a seven-year-old could understand. So yeah, you've got to be, you know, we've got to be ready at whatever age. What, anybody else? Other reasons? Yeah.
Well, I agree with you on the influence of secular culture. I feel like, you know, we spend as much time with them as they'll let us. And, you know, we take them to church and we do youth group and, you know,
Yeah.
Because every song, and I had a rule growing up, you know, if anybody's getting busy in the back seat or swearing, you know, you're out. You don't get to pick the music, you know, or
right.
whatever.
Right.
That's the way it was. And
right.
So they all knew, let's just make mom happy with some Christian music.
Right.
But it's just, they're completely, so they're, it's the 90-10.
Yeah.
That's the hard part that we're dealing with.
Yes. That's really good. The night that we get about 10, especially as they get older, 10%. The world's getting about 90. So what are we going to do to make that 10% the most valuable 10% we can? And that's really what we're going to be talking about is, you know, how do we make that happen? So moving on to the good news. I'm sorry, you're probably like, I'm so out of here. This is so depressing. I'm just going to back up and go home. It's not good. No, the good news, there are things that we can do. And the first thing is to realize that parents do matter. All of the research still shows, and even the most recent research, that parents continue to be the single greatest influence on their children's faith. So that's really good news. There were studies that were done, a 35-year-long study of families focusing on that question of how religion is passed across generations, and that was the bottom line that they found. So that is really good news, is that even if you think you're not influencing, you can be an influence. A key resource let me recommend to you, I'm hoping that the bookstore has this, and these are all, everything I mentioned is in your handout as well. This is from the woman who founded the Fuller Youth Institute, Kara Powell. This is called Sticky Faith, Everyday Ideas to Build Lasting Faith into Your Kids. And what I like, and she has a follow-up book there that's in your handout, The Sticky Faith Guide to Your Family. That was her more recent one. But both of these are full of very practical ideas, because she said it's not about sitting your kids down and lecturing them like a college professor, you know, starting when they're 7 years old about things. It's about integrating faith into life in a way that helps them understand its relevance and helps actually build faith into them. So there's all kinds of ideas. The second one I think has, I don't know, 100 ideas, but obviously you're not going to do all of them, but they're very practical and ways for you to go, you know what, that's something we could do and that I could do. So I just really recommend those resources for you. Also, they've got a website, the Fuller, which I also gave you there, stickyfaith.org. There's all kinds of blog posts there that they, again, they're constantly doing new research. And so it's just a great resource for you to see what they're talking about. One of the things that they bring out in both of their books about what parents can do is this idea of creating a home environment of warmth and grace and unconditional love. We can't underestimate the importance of our home environment that we are creating with our kids. Warmth means a sense of closeness, and you don't get to be the one who says, oh yeah, I'm really close to my kid. They're the one, actually. It's what they say. Do they feel close to you? Do they feel warmth in their home? It's not what you think. Oh, I'm absolutely making a warm home. It's what they think. And also this grace. How do we walk that amazingly challenging line of disciplining our children and teaching them to be civilized human beings and all of those things, but also showing grace to our children We have to learn. We have to be very intentional about grace in our homes and also unconditional love. Unconditional love does not say, whatever you do, I will support all your choices. That is not unconditional love. The Father does not love us that way. He doesn't say, do whatever you want, it's fine. No, He loves us when we do things that He says, that's really stupid, or that is sinful, or that's immoral. He continues to love us and to call us back to Him. That's the kind of unconditional love. So our kids need to know, even our kids that are walking away from the faith, I love you. You are my son, my daughter. There's nothing you can do that will make me not actually love you. I cannot support what you're doing right now, but I still love you, and I want you to know that. So communicating unconditional love is really important. Now, warmth, this was actually, family warmth was in that 35-year study was more correlated with faith transmission than any other relational factor. A sense of warmth. So how do you build warmth? Well, they've got some ideas on that blog site about building warmth. I know in our family, one of the things that became difficult, we had a lot of warmth in our family, I would say when the kids were younger. My husband came from a very huggy kind of family. So, and I didn't, but we became a very huggy family. Because that's how he grew up, and I grew to really like that too. I know it's going to sound weird to you, but it's not instinctual for me to hug my children. I'm sorry. It's just how I was raised, my family of origin, who loved me, but that's just not primarily how they showed love. So it was something I had to really learn and had to think about. Now, when I had my oldest son, one night he said, "Good night, Mom," and the next morning he said, "Good morning, Mom," and I'm like, his voice changed overnight. My younger son went through the whole cracking thing, but my oldest son, it was just like one night he's a little boy, and the next day he's a young man. And I realized that I kind of had quit hugging him because I'm like, well, he's a young man. I probably shouldn't do that. I told him, I said, "Hun, I made all my mistakes with you because you were always the first one that had ever reached that phase, and I didn't quite know what to do." But I realized later that actually, even our boys need, and our teenagers need hugs from us, because it communicates warmth. And it's so hard when you are locking heads with them over some issue, right? And you're kind of mad at each other. They're mad at you slamming the door, and you're saying, "I will absolutely not." And then it's like, how do you maintain family warmth in that situation? It's a challenge. It has to be very intentional. So when they finally come out of the room, you hug them and say, "I know we really disagree on this, but I want you to know I love you." You know, reestablishing that warmth, it's hard to do. I'm not saying that's easy, because you're probably still like, "I know better than them. Why do they think they know?" You know. So, but they are adolescent. They are juveniles. That's the definition of the phase they are in. And so we have to be the adults and can continue to show that warmth to them. That's so important. Another way to say parents matter, bring your children into your faith life. Do they know how faith actually functions in your life? Do you show them? We sat down with our kids once and showed them our checkbook back in the days when we used checks. Now it's all lovely, you know, bill pay from my bank. But we said, "Look, we just want you to show you, because we want to follow Jesus. And the Bible tells us that taking care of the poor is right at the heart of God. We want to show you what we spend every month on these things and on supporting the church and all of its ministries. And that's why sometimes, you know, we can't buy everything that we want. But we want them to understand that this is how faith is functioning in our life when it comes to our money. Do you bring your kids into that? Or you're like, "Man, that would tell everybody how much we make," you know? No, I think it's good to bring them into that. Or if there's, you know, if you're struggling financially, to say, "You know what? I'm really having to trust God this month. And I know that He has always said He'll take care of us. I don't know exactly how He's going to do that, but that's what I'm praying, is that he shows me how this is all going to work. Bringing them into the ways that your that faith is actually functioning in your life is really healthy. Making regular space for conversation, not only is that a key to warmth, but also it's just a great place for these 10% conversations, you know, that 10% to take place in your family. Now, where does that happen? In our family, I was a stickler for the family dinner. I told Renee, I don't care what's going on at church. You are home at 6 o'clock for dinner. If you're in the middle of crisis counseling, tell them, I'll be back in an hour. You know, I'm going home for dinner. So that was such an important time for us. And as our kids got older into high school, they told me, Mom, nobody sits down and has dinner with their family. I'm like, what? They're like, none of our friends. When we tell our friends, oh, I have to be home for dinner, they're like, you sit down to dinner? I'm like, well, what do they do? And she said, well, you know, they drive through the drive-in, you know, because they're going from one event to another. They eat in the car. Or the mom says, there's a pizza in the oven. I'm going to my yoga class, whatever. Or just the working schedule. She said they actually started kind of asking all their friends. And like, they said, like, none of our friends. Like, you could say 5 times a week they sit down to family dinner. But that was the best time. The best time, because either milk was coming out of somebody's nose because we were laughing so hard, which builds warmth, or somebody out of the blue was asking a question or bringing up a topic that was on their mind, something they'd heard at school, and it gave us a chance. Our dinners were never more than a half an hour. You know, I mean, I'm not a gourmet cook. It wasn't a 7-course meal or anything. It's like spaghetti and salad and, you know, I mean, really simple stuff. But we all sat down and ate together. And I just love it. I think back on some of the, I remember my son one night, my oldest, just out of the blue, he was a teenager, going, so how do we really know that Jesus rose from the dead? And I was just like, inside, jumping up and down. And I told him, I said, that's a good question. And it shows me that you're not going to be somebody who just believes anything anybody tells you. And that's a good thing. Because generally, people don't rise from the dead, right? I mean, we don't go and hang out by grandmommy's grave going, I don't know, she might. You know, let's wait and see. No, we pretty much know that she's gone and is not coming back to this life. So so you affirm, first of all, that that's a great question. And then you're ready. And you don't download N.T. Wright's Resurrection of the Son of God in that moment. The kids are usually ready for a few things, and then they're like, oh, great, pass the Parmesan. You know, they're ready to move on. But you've had a moment where they've had a little window to go, okay, this is not an unreasonable thing for me to believe. There is something there. There is an answer to this. If you don't have an answer, you still go, that's a good question. I've actually never thought of that. Let me get back to you, you know, and then you go and you do your research. But it's a good, that making place for conversation. Something else that happened, my youngest son, when he was 16, he decided he did not want to get his driver's license. He just was not an adventurous kind of kid. And he's like, I don't really want to get it. I'll get it when I'm 18. And part of me was like, great, I don't have to pay the insurance, right? But the other part of me was like, I have been driving kids to school for the past decade and a half, and it would just be really nice not to have to do that. And then I realized as I drove him 20 minutes to school every day and 20 minutes home every day, there was that space for conversation that I normally would not have with a teenage son. And sometimes we rode in companionable silence, and sometimes we had the most amazing conversations. And I realized what a deep thinker he was. You know, I would ask questions, and I'm like, this kid thinks very deeply. He's our quietest kid. Our other two are very vocal, and he's very quiet. And it's great in those quiet moments for the introvert. You have to give him a lot of space. You have to agree to have a lot of silence with the rest of the whole family being fill-in-the-blank people. You have to work at that with an introvert. But eventually, he'll go, you know, I've been thinking. and then it comes out, and it's great. So make space. You know, if we're rushing from thing to thing to thing, we cannot create the space. So you have something. You're very excited.
The car situation is what I was going to...
Yeah.
There was a period when we were having a lot of conflict with our son.
Yeah.
So I started reading all kinds of books to try to equip myself.
Right.
And one of the authors I read said, it's a little too intense to sit your kid down.
Yes.
Like for coffee or at a table and do the eye thing. And
right. Right.
It's a really different dynamic.
Sure.
It takes a little bit of the vulnerability
sure.
away. And
yeah.
I really appreciated that. And I actually became kind of strategic when I was in the car with my kid to remember to bring up certain topics if the time felt right that I don't
right.
think I could have done.
Right.
Right. You need to sit down and talk.
Right.
Different dynamic.
And if you're like, my kid doesn't talk, questions. You know, learn the Socratic method. Of just and if they say something that you immediately go that is so off the wall stupid, that's not the response you want to have. Okay, you want to go, huh? I have a friend of mine. She was an expert at this. Whenever we were talking, and she'd go, huh? I'm like, I know what that means. You don't agree with it, but you just kind of have to go, huh? Tell me how you arrived at that conclusion, or tell me how you got there. Then you're helping them be critical thinkers, and you're also kind of learning how did they get to that spot. And maybe they realize they don't know how they got to that spot, which is also a good thing for them to realize. So asking questions in the car or letting them just bring something up, it's just a great spot. Anybody else love the car time with kids? Are you making use of that? Okay. So I don't know how it's going to look like in your family, but if you think about your life right now and you go, there is no space, then that's a recipe for disaster in terms of building faith into your kids. And also just making clear that questions and doubts are okay. I throw this in there because there have been people that have told me, yeah, if I asked any of hard questions, I was just told, you know, well, you just have to have faith. Or that's a sin to doubt or to ask a question like that. That's sinning or whatever. So we have to give our kids the freedom to know that King David had doubts. Job had doubts. Abraham had doubts. So doubting is a part of the faith life. So that's okay. And it's good to have these questions because we know there's a lot of people telling us things out there. And so it's good to have questions about what we're being told. So that's really important. Yes.
Doubting is not just
it's unique to humanity. Right. 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 Yes. Doubting people there are people who have absolute certainty about everything. They're on the extremes of some kind of religious faith and some kind of a naturalistic, atheistic faith. Most people in the middle are what Tim Keller calls cross-pressured people, meaning that they're, for the atheists, they can't explain beauty and a sense of transcendence and a quest for meaning and purpose. Why would our biology need that? And for the Christian, there's questions regarding our faith and how prayer works and I can't see God. And, you know, so we have questions too. So all of human life actually... that's a good point. We, you know, there's doubts all along the way. So, and the other thing, and I really should have put this first, is do pray for your kids and for their own faith development and ask for wisdom from the Lord for how you can be a part of building faith into their lives, because parents do matter. And then second, remember that it's about the gospel. It's about the gospel. We want to make sure that we don't communicate to our kids either directly or indirectly that somehow Christianity is a package that goes along with some political party or agenda, or no matter which party or agenda you're of, that or that there isn't room in the Christian family for disagreement about peripheral things. We have to keep centered on the gospel. Because in the end, your kids are probably going to see things a little differently than you. I certainly see things differently than my folks did. Each of us will have a unique relationship with God and how we work that out. But if we want to keep the gospel at the heart of that, because it really is the gospel that has the power to transform us anyway. And what I mean by the gospel is, you know, the big story of the Bible, that of what we are as human beings, that we sin against God, that we go our own way, we grab autonomy for ourselves, and that we need a Savior and we need Jesus to bring us back. And it's all through God's grace and love that has been made. That is at the core, and that love can transform us. So it's, you know, it's not moralism, because you could end up with kids that live a moral life that you approve of, but they're not actually people of faith, you know, because you don't actually need faith to live a good moral life, bottom line. So if you're teaching moralism or some kind of politics, I think we have to keep kids centered on the gospel. Now, I'm going to recommend a book here. If you have a teenager who likes to read, it's a book called This Changes Everything, How the Gospel Transforms the Teen Years. What I love about this book is it was written by a teenager. She was 19 when she wrote this book. Okay, yes, she was extraordinary. But I like that she uses language that teenagers are going to relate to. She has life experiences that teenagers are going to relate to. And this just came out last year. I think she's 20 now. So this is a very current book. It talks about social media. It talks about the, you know, things that kids, that their everyday life is about. Let me just play this. You can actually grab off the internet. It's just the promo for the book. What I like about it, it can be used in like a small group setting, because there's Q&A questions at the end, so you could be done like a chapter a week with a small group. You know, you can recommend it maybe to your youth pastor. Let me just show you the promo for it.
Let me ask you a question. Has the gospel changed your life? Sure, you can say you believe there's a God, or you were raised in a Christian family, or you're involved in church activities. But has the gospel really changed you? Because that's what makes Jesus different. If he's really entered your life, it will be transformed to the core. If the gospel is true, it will change the things you believe, think, say, and do. It will change your goals and what you treasure, the way you look at yourself and the way you relate to others, the way you invest your time and passion, even what you do for entertainment. Truth is, our lives can't remain the same from the moment Jesus is in us. We become part of a countercultural movement that defies the status quo, stereotypes, and the culture of self. Regardless of our age or experience, we become part of it. We become part of a kingdom and a story and an adventure that changes absolutely everything. So has the gospel changed your life?
So I love that. I love how it's presented, because it's true. The gospel has something that guides us into all those big human questions about meaning and purpose and freedom and identity and hope, all those things that our secular culture has a totally different story about. So keeping the gospel at the center also keeps your kids from saying, well, because I don't believe this peripheral thing, I guess I have to walk away from the whole thing. It allows them to know that there are differences of opinion. We're going to talk about some of those tomorrow in the realm of science, that we can be brothers and sisters in Christ and have the gospel centered, even if we disagree on how to interpret the first chapter of Genesis, for instance. And I think that's a really important message that our kids need to know, that it's the gospel that's at the heart. So that's a highly recommended book for you. Also, just finishing up here for today, rethink ways to connect young people to the church family. Now, this is really important, because I think the way we've traditionally done church is we kind of keep kids in their age-appropriate programs until they graduate high school, and then we say, well, you go away to college, and when you come back, maybe there's some adult things for you to do in the church. The problem is, are they going to come back? And, you know, when I was growing up, I don't know about you, but when we had a lot of company over at our house, my mom would make a kids' table, right? And I loved sitting at the kids' table when I was a little kid, because we could do all kinds of things that, you know, throw things or whatever that we couldn't normally do at the table. And our parents didn't care because they were all having lovely adult conversations and we were happy at our kids' table. But eventually I did reach an age where if my mom said, well, I'm going to put you at the kids' table, where I was like, well, I don't want to be at the kids' table. Maybe I was only 14 or 15, but I was like, I'm a grown-up. You know, that's how I felt. And I think maybe we need to recognize that our kids need to be brought into that full life of the church, the adult life of the church, at an earlier age than we're doing that now. So, and it's not just about service. There's many aspects of church life that I think we can bring them into. But one of the keys to bringing them in, and one of the reasons we should, is for them to make connections with the generational variety that is in our church. So do your kids know senior citizens, and do those senior citizens know your kids? Not grandma and grandpa if they go to your church. Not relatives, but just, you know, people in the church who are of a different age group or a different kind of person than you usually hang out with. Those kind of connections that build into your child a sense that they are part of a greater family. They found in their research that generally if kids have a 5-to-1 ratio, so for every kid there are 5 unrelated adults that know that kid and they know them. And even, you know, things like they're going to be in a play and these people will come and see the play, or they ask, how was your test? I was praying for you. I know you had that big science test. They actually know about their lives, and those kids know about their lives and their stories of faith. That kind of connection actually helps a kid stay through all the turmoil they're going to go through when they get older. This has been borne out in my own family because we did these connections, and I know we're right here to the time. We did these connections through, it wasn't really a small group, it was a football group. We all liked to watch football. We'd gather on Sunday afternoons from the time our kids were really little all the way through high school. We would get together, and they got to know these other adults. Dave Hicks was one of them, and they're single women and so forth. And what I found when I talked to my kids in preparation for this, I said, well, who really influenced you in those years when you had doubts? They started naming this single woman who is part of our group. Yeah, you don't know, but I went and talked to her one time when I was really struggling with something. Really? You did? You don't know, but I'm like, she asked me once because she saw on Facebook that I had posted something, and she picked up that I had just broken up with my girlfriend, and she came up to me and put her arms around me. I know it's a tough time right now. Those kind of connections are priceless for your kids, because it's like, this is a family and you're a part of it. So we're going to continue tomorrow. The big thing we're going to look at tomorrow, I'm going to go through and show you some videos and all kinds of cool research. People have done the hard work for you. And so I'm going to show you just the resources that are available to you to help parent your kid when they do come up with questions like, how do we know there's a God? So we'll look at that tomorrow. Thank you very much.
Thank you.